Listener supported. WNYC Studios.
I'm Amy Eddings, sitting in for Brian Lehrer. It's hard to imagine why New Jersey is called the Garden State if your only experience of it is along the New Jersey Turnpike between the Holland Tunnel and the George Washington Bridge. But New Jersey has a rich gastronomic heritage, one that Chef Jim Weaver is trying to preserve and cultivate. He's the founder and chef of Tre Piani in Princeton, New Jersey, and the founder of the Central New Jersey chapter of Slow Food USA. He's also the author of Locavore Adventures, One Chef's Slow Food Journey, published by Rutgers Press. Welcome to WNYC.
Thank you for having me.
Tell me about Tre Piani. How'd you get into the restaurant business?
Well, I always think that the restaurant, you know, found me, and I just always enjoyed cooking from an early age, and so I kind of backed into it from a chef standpoint and ended up, you know, owning the whole place. So
owning the joint.
Yeah, right.
Did you start at the on the line and then?
I started as a dishwasher in high
way.
School, not at Tre Piani, okay. But at various restaurants. And I was fortunate enough to become a head chef of a restaurant at a very young age of 23, which I took to be number one rated Italian restaurant in the state of New Jersey. And then now with Tre Piani, I started as the chef and became a partner and bought out partners and.
Now it's all yours.
Bought out everybody and expanded. Yeah, right.
And why Italian food?
It was what I had the opportunity to start with. And when I really started researching it, I really came to love it because it is just real cooking. I mean, it's the real deal. I mean, it's classic European style, but it's all about what's in season, what's local. And I love that.
The slow food movement got its start in Italy in 1986 in opposition to a McDonald's that was going to open near Rome's Spanish Steps. What aspect of its message appealed to you and got you founding the Central New Jersey chapter?
Well, it kind of gave me purpose. You know, when I got a brochure in the mail many, many years ago, and I had not even heard of the slow food movement, and it really wasn't even much of a presence in the United States at that time, and that was early 1999 or late 1998, I read through it and I said, wow, this really is everything I believe in and gives me it helped me find strength to try to find a way to solve the problems that I was facing as a chef in New Jersey.
And what were those problems?
Well, a lot of it was distribution. I mean, the Garden State is the name of the Garden State because it historically was the breadbasket for the great cities of New York and Philadelphia. And those distributions were set up, the systems were set up early on, and they're really still in place. And I said to myself, it doesn't make sense that I could drive to my restaurant, which is 5 miles away, and pass about a dozen farms that I can't buy directly from. It's just ridiculous. And
That tomato is making – it's going, what, to a distribution center somewhere in Philly and then being shipped back to you?
It goes to a co-op that the farmer has to pay to join and has the privilege of getting the lowest profit possible price for. And then it goes through a series of middlemen and into the big out-of-state markets and then shipped back to me. So it's days later. It's anonymous. It's more expensive and the quality is lower. So I said that just doesn't
– Let's talk about the tomato. A tenet of the slow food movement is to promote traditional and regional cuisine like Genoa sausage or French croissants or pecorino romano cheese. New Jersey's food heritage very strongly, the tomato front and center. Everyone is familiar with the Jersey tomato. Is there such a thing?
Ironically, no. And I learned this through my research of the book. And although I was familiar with a lot of species of tomatoes, I thought the Jersey tomato was a brand, but it's really a trademark of a company in South Jersey. The Ramapo tomato is a variety that was put together by Rutgers University Extension. And it's really the closest one to the real – what people think of as the Jersey tomato. And it's gone through changes over the years.
The Ramapo tomato is the one they're working on now. It was the Rutgers tomato in the 1930s that everybody associates. Tell me about the Rutgers tomato. You were describing in your book they really wanted to make it for shipping, for transport, and they were dropping it on the macadam of the road. And if it split open,
tomato is something you eat, but flavor was not an issue in deciding which tomatoes were the best for commercial purposes. And that's the same thing with still these days and a lot of things you see in the supermarket. So, but and that's where the magic happens. You know, when you get the chefs and the scientists together, and you start talking about, okay, I understand it has to be marketability aspects to it, but it has to taste good as well. So what's happening.
Can you still grow a Rutgers tomato? Are the seeds still around from that 1934 variety?
I don't know if the original seeds are around, to be honest with you. There are a lot of organizations, Seed Savers, for instance, and whatnot, that maintains all those things. But, I mean, there's been so many hybrids between now and then that it's hard to tell.
And the latest one that the Rutgers, New Jersey Agricultural Experiment Station that you wrote about is working on is called the Ramapo tomato. You had mentioned it earlier. They're trying to combine the great qualities of today's hybrids like yield and disease resistance with the great qualities of heirloom like taste. Is it on the market yet, the Ramapo?
It is to some extent. It's again, I mean, it's really up to the farmers what they want to grow and what's working for them. You know, the Jersey tomato as it is, I mean, has certain characteristics that it has to stand by in order to be sold commercially when they're in season. So it's they're getting back to that right now, but it's not necessarily 100% Ramapo tomato.
How can a slow food movement support a hybrid like the Ramapo? Aren't hybrids anathema to the movement's principles of heritage varieties?
Hey, you know, times change. I mean, aren't human beings hybrids really when you think about it? So I don't think that's really new there. I mean, Rutgers has been instrumental on an international level of bringing quality food and sustainable foods and helping farmers sustain their farms and be able to make money on small and large scale. So I don't think it makes that much difference.
I'm intrigued by the role of foie gras in the slow food movement. You use foie gras at your restaurant. You source it from Hudson Valley foie gras in New York, Sullivan County. Foie gras, of course, is the fattened liver of ducks that have been force-fed corn. That process, gavage, is considered by animal rights activists to be a form of torture. Is it? Does the process bother you?
Not at all. I saw it firsthand. And Izzy Yane, who is an utmost professional and probably the number one guy for producing it maybe in the world, gave me a private tour of the whole thing. He had nothing to hide, the whole thing. And it's natural. I mean, you know, birds and human beings are built differently. That's the bottom line. So, think about birds that eat whole fish, bones and all, you know, where a human being couldn't possibly do that. So physiologically, it's a completely different thing. And it's natural. I mean, the way they do it is not necessarily natural, but it's natural for birds to gorge before migration because the fat that is stored as energy, and they need that energy for migration. The difference is that, you know, they're put down before the migration process, and so all that fat is still stored in the liver, and that's the foie gras.
Slow Food USA, as you mentioned in the book, hasn't taken an official position, but International Slow Food protects and promotes French foie gras as an important part of France's history and culture. Why do you include it when talking about the slow food network you're trying to develop in central New Jersey?
Well, I think it's a controversial subject, and so I think that's fun to read about and learn the real deal about. So, I mean, you know, animals are part. I mean, we're omnivores, and in this case, we're locavore omnivores. But you know, animals are bred to eat, and you're talking about animals that would not even have a life if they were not meant for human consumption. And so, ironically, we're saving a lot of species by eating them. And these ducks happen to be one of those.
Do you think foie gras will eventually be a food that only France will be able to practice because of its deep connection with that country's culinary tradition? Do you think the U.S. will eventually follow Germany, the U.K., Switzerland, and the state of California and ban it?
I hope not. I mean, I think it's really just such an unimportant issue on overall with what else is going on in the world that, I mean, it's an expensive food thing, and I think it'll always be there, and people will find out a way to get it, and hopefully they can allow it to still be produced by farms that are doing it in a responsible way rather than backyard things like people making, you know, still bourbon that's illegal in other parts of the country. So, you know, as long as you keep it legal, you keep it clean and right.
A slow food tenet that you quote is food that is good, clean, and fair. What do we mean by fair? You describe a dinner at Chef Dan Barber's Blue Hill at Stone Barns. $600 by the end of it. It sounded like you had a wonderful meal.
Oh, we didn't
meal.
Skip on the wine.
Yeah, right? Fair, perhaps, but not affordable for the 99%.
Well,
so what does
true.
Fair mean?
Well, that's actually a phrase that was coined by Carlo Petrini, who incidentally started the movement and wrote the foreword for my book. But it means it's, you know, it's good for the earth, and it's fair to the people that produce it as well, and it's clean for you to consume. So altogether, it's a pristine thing that is that's sustainable.
And fairness means farmers being able to make a living off
make a fair price off it. That's correct.
Yep. Fair price off of it. You write that the slow food movement suggests a way to make things better, but without going the political route. What do you mean by that?
Well, because we're more of an educational organization than anything else. I mean, just as, you know, obviously with the primaries and everything going on, you see all the mudslinging going on and stuff like that. And that's not what we're about. We're about promoting what's right rather than pointing out what's wrong. And in the long run, there'll always be a place for slow food because it's right now the only food system, food system that's sustainable. The big mass-produced system is not good, clean, and fair, and it's not sustainable in the long run. And so it's going to cause a lot of problems.
Do you think we need a political route, though, to address the systemic problems underlying our food system, like addressing food deserts or steering subsidies away from corn and soybeans and toward maybe organic vegetables?
Well, I think it's just a matter of time. It'll absolutely go there anyway because the strongest human motivator is self-preservation. So when we start running out of food that is that's able to sustain us, we're going to do something about it.
Jim Weaver, the author of Locavore Adventure, One Chef's Slow Food Journey, published by Rutgers Press. He's the chef of Tre Piani in Princeton. Thanks so much for coming in. It was a pleasure meeting you.
Thanks for having me. I appreciate it.
This is WNYC AM and FM New York, WNYC.org. Stay with us. Another hour of The Brian Lehrer Show coming up after news headlines.